The explosive new film, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, exposes secrets behind the government's takedown of General Michael Flynn.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
He told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire. They had to get rid of Flynn.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.
Thanks for listening to the Town Hall Review with Hugh Hewitt podcast, bringing to you the best voices on the stories and issues that matter. Helping make it all possible is the generous partnership with the Pepperdine Graduate School of Public Policy. Here's another piece I'll trust you enjoy.
Pete Peterson, he is the dean at the Pepperdine School of Public Policy. Their website, publicpolicy.pepperdine.edu. When you're thinking about yourself or even perhaps your children or for that matter, your grandchildren or anyone, you know, looking to go into public policy, you know the problems in education and in higher education particularly. Pepperdine School of Public Policy is the answer to those problems. Pete, this is my first opportunity to wish you a Happy New Year. Happy New Year.
And to you too, Seth. Great to be back with you for 2022.
Yeah, thank you. I appreciate it so very much. I wanted to run something by you a little bit and see what your thought might be. You know, this week we saw a, you take it whatever direction you like, but this week we saw a Quinnipiac poll that has Biden's approval at hovering around 33%, President Biden's approval rating at about 33%. And it makes me ask the question, who are those 33% that can point to anything good this administration is doing? And then I was reading some other polls here in Arizona on a lot of cultural issues, parental rights and education, some of the transgender stuff. And it seemed like they were getting between 25 and 35% approval ratings. And I'm beginning to wonder if that's the country we live in right now, that there is a hard left. It constitutes maybe 30 to 35% of the country, and their noise outweighs their numbers. But that there is a constituency in this country of left-wingers that is about a third of the country. And I wonder if I would just love to get your thoughts on that.
Yeah, I think that's very possible. You know, I give thought to one of the more comprehensive national political studies done by a group out of the UK called More in Common. And it was called the Political Tribes Survey. And they essentially, this was about 2 or 3 years ago, highlighted in a bunch of different places. They broke up the entire American electorate into 6 or 7 political tribes, from certainly strong conservative to strong progressive. And you're definitely looking at least 15 to 20%
okay,
who would fit into the hard the stronger progressive side. And then, of course, you can bring people across who I think don't want to be seen as regretting their vote for President Biden and are not yet willing to give up on him, that are going to constitute that 33 or 35%.
The rest of that slice of the pie. Yeah, I can see that.
Yep.
Yeah, the difficulty people have in climbing down from their positions when they realize they might have been wrong or that they were wrong. And it ties a little bit to an AEI study you had tweeted or at least retweeted, right? The very liberal in America are different. They have become more and more left wing over time. I was kind of reading through that, and it was kind of an amazing thing for me to see what I did see there. 48% of very liberal Americans report posting online about their politics, compared to just 23% of moderates and 30% of conservatives. They kind of dominate the spaces we kind of listen to the most, don't they?
They do, and that particular study was bracing in the sense that for many of us as politically engaged conservatives who do utilize social media, it can be a place where sometimes we do wonder how representative it is. And certainly the results of this study by the American Enterprise Institute demonstrates that it's not at all.
Yeah.
the Twitterverse is not at all representative. And not only that for those on the political left, that can be a place of consuming time and energy. You know, there was another study, and we've talked about this issue of loneliness before.
Yep.
And just to tie these two threads together, AEI actually did and Sam Abrams there, who I know has done a lot of great survey work, did a piece on loneliness, which showed that those who are the most politically engaged happen to be more lonely than those who aren't engaged in any other civic activity.
Do that again for me. That sounds super important. I don't think I'd heard that. Do that again for me in the audience. Do that again.
Yeah. So the study was on those who are involved in either civic or political participation.
Sure.
And from those who are involved in their churches, local business organizations, or politically. And one of the bracing parts of that were that those who were involved in those civic enterprises, church, business, so forth, are far less lonely than the general population. But those who describe themselves as only being involved politically are actually more lonely than the population, right? And to drill down a step deeper, what they found is those that tend to comprise that, what you might call hyper-politically engaged group, generally tend to be those of college education or higher, and definitely more those on the political left. And they definitely tend to engage more via social media than actually in person. So very much in accordance with this other study that we're talking about here.
So the tough thing with this is, and we've also discussed this before, I wonder if your thoughts have changed or expanded. It's been a while since we did, we did it in the context of the university, but we might as well do it in the context of social media. Conservatives are now going about building, in some cases, their own new platforms, and it's a very difficult thing to do, and there will be fits and starts, as there are with any new enterprise. But do you think that that is going to be better than not engaging on the traditional ones that we already know, in the sense that I'm not so sure it was better that conservatives, obviously you and your school are the exception. Hillsdale might be an exception.
Yes.
Right. They have gone to the think tanks rather than the universities. And so we leave those things to sink under their leftism. You understand the point I'm trying to ask here. Yeah.
I do very much. And I do think that there are people that will be engaged in social media that in, say, if they were to leave Twitter and go to one of these newer platforms, that's not necessarily going to encourage more conservatives be engaged
in
social
media. That's my worry.
I kind of think it's a zero-sum game there, that those who will be engaged in social media will be, and those who won't. And it will just further exacerbate the ideological leaning of these platforms. I think what's so difficult, and maybe in some ways the remedy, is to constantly remember, as people on the right, that the Twitterverse is not reality, to borrow a phrase, while still understanding that it is a place of communicating and understanding, and receiving, news and learning about new things.
I agree with your analysis on that. And what I want to kind of make plain here, and you're training young minds into entering the world of public policy, is that when we become so siloed, and I happen to think the left is more siloed than the right for two reasons. Feel free to argue the point or disagree too if you want. One is, I think we are naturally more intellectually curious, but also we can't avoid the culture we live in, which is dominated by the left. You can't avoid it. They can avoid conservatism. They can avoid, the other side can avoid our stuff. And you saw it in sharp relief exactly a week ago when Supreme Court Justice Sonia Sotomayor was just broadcasting myths in open in open court, right, in open oral argument, that she would not be broadcasting, A, if she read briefs from the other side, which is its own tell, but B, if she was reading something other than the press releases of the D.C. mayor, I think. This is what that leads to, right? Yeah. It has serious implications.
It really does, and you're right. It was put in bold relief there by Justice Sotomayor essentially revealing where she's getting her information from. I do think that regular conservative engagement on these platforms and in these institutions more broadly, obviously this is the argument that I keep trying to make to conservatives, especially conservative students who just want to wipe their hands of academia.
Yeah.
I think actually the costs of that are almost incalculable. And in that, we need to continue to promote and encourage smart conservatives to get involved in academia, because that's, in the end, it's a vital civic institution and one that we need to bend back the moral arc that academia is currently on. But to your point about breaking through these echo chambers, it's important for the broader public square, which is sometimes outlined and certainly developed by social media, that conservatives continue to engage there, because those may be the only places where those on the left, and sometimes they can be in positions of power, hear a different point of view.
That position of power is the tough one, right? Because
yep.
There's a supply-demand pull here. I left academia because I couldn't find I knew the market for a white male who likes Aristotle is a shrinking market. Pete Peterson, the dean at the Pepperdine School of Public Policy, is our guest. I wanted to ask him one more question on academia. Then I wanted to ask him about an interesting essay that's circulating from The Atlantic magazine, not David Brooks's, one that you're probably going to see getting less publicity, and you'll see why in a moment, but it deserves more. Pete, first on that question, what do you advise students who want to go into academia, knowing that those doors aren't exactly always open to them if they think the way you or I do, or if they want to study dead white males? There are ways, there are schools, and I would just love to know what the advice is that you give.
Well, I think there are two questions here. One is, for the conservative student that was a calling towards academia to get a PhD, are there opportunities even to learn these things in order to earn your PhD?
Yeah, that's a good point, too. Yeah, right.
Positions afterwards.
Yeah.
Now, on both those counts, I'm actually optimistic. We are seeing more of these doctoral and certainly postdoc programs for PhD candidates in classically liberal disciplines.
Good.
And academic specializations.
Good.
That I'm optimistic that they'll be able to gain those PhDs in fields that they're supportive of. And then the next step, I really am, over the course of the next 5 or 10 years, optimistic about the opportunities to teach and engage as an academic on these issues. Again, if I'm speaking to a master's student, or certainly an undergrad, you're still 5 to 7 years away from getting your PhD and getting out into the job market.
That's right.
And so in that, I do think we're going to see those opportunities increasingly available.
And some new schools maybe, perhaps, right? Right? We were talking
Absolutely.
About the Austin experiment, for example.
And not just that, but one of the ways, I hate to reveal something for maybe some prying eyes, but what we're starting to see, even in very progressive colleges and universities, you're starting to see the growth of these honors colleges.
Yeah, right.
And
we
so
have them at ASU.
Within,
right.
You do.
Yeah.
That's right. You know, the great work that's being done in a couple of the different centers there at ASU,
yeah,
are just a couple of examples. But we're seeing this across the country where you can find these opportunities, even in otherwise very progressive colleges and universities.
Yep.
You find these oases there.
Like the Madison program at Princeton, for example.
Exactly.
Might be,
right.
Is the kind of thing you're thinking of, yeah, as well. Perfect. Let me mention this piece in The Atlantic. It's by an author named Angie Schmidt, Why I Soured on the Democrats. COVID school policies set me adrift from my tribe. This is a Cleveland mother. And she was she establishes her Democratic Party bona fides. She would describe herself that way. She would embrace it. She does.
Yep.
So I'm not being pejorative here. And how she is not yet changing her ideology,
but she can't trust the Democratic Party anymore. That is what she concludes.
Yeah, and of course, the crux of her political change, or at least her partisan identification, has been on COVID response, and particularly in K-12 education.
Yeah.
This is someone who is in lives in Cleveland. Angie Schmidt is her name.
Yep.
And wrote this piece essentially out of deep frustration for what she rightly perceived was an unscientific and, frankly, very self-interested on the part of teachers' unions moves to keep K-12 schools closed, including the ones in which she had her kids. And so one of the concluding paragraphs, just to quote a couple brief sentences, just shows where she's at. She goes, none of this has shaken my support for the Democratic agenda, which I still endorse. What I've lost is my trust that the party is truly motivated to act in the interests of those they claim to serve. How can I get excited about universal pre-K proposals, for example, when K-12 is in shambles?
Right.
And so this is, to me, just one example of millions of what I would call latter-day, if not neocons, certainly Democrats who've been mugged by the reality of these policies, again, mostly at the local level, whether it's in K-12 education or public safety, but all revealed by COVID response at the state and local level.
I love this line of hers. The left-leaning rhetorical response to the pandemic seems out of line with Democratic stated values, or stated values of the Democratic Party, as she sees them, of course. And she's talking about the Democratic Party that a lot of people used to associate with caring about kids, caring about education, caring about these things. And we're thinking this may be the avenue where we're going to find our new recruits from. Conservatives are going to see perhaps, at least on some issues at first, and maybe expanding into other issues as they go along once they like the temperature of the water. Maybe this is going to be where we find our new recruits into our movement, possibly.
No, I think it's and we certainly already have the example of the Virginia election, gubernatorial election, to demonstrate that this is real. And as much as the left wants to portray this as just some sort of reaction to CRT, what's not being brought in is this kind of conversation, which is about the closing of schools and the COVID response.
Right.
And certainly that also played a role in the closeness of the New Jersey gubernatorial election.
Yep.
And it played a significant role, as we talked about before, Seth, in the fact that we even had a gubernatorial recall here in California.
Yeah.
Now, I know everybody wants to say, well, it was a wipeout once it actually came to the ballot. But what's easily overseen there is we had a governor in 2018 who had won by one of the great landslides in California history, having to even stand for a recall 3 years hence. And I think that's
having
that
to
really
spend millions of dollars to justify his tenure. Yeah.
And so much of it was so many of those signatories on the initiative to get it to ballot were parents who were deeply unhappy with the COVID response and the closure of schools. So this education piece, I think, is significant. Obviously, the public safety issue is another one that we're seeing in so many American cities. Obviously, the homelessness crisis, which is also occurring, particularly here in California, but also in the country. These, if you will, quality of life issues, which are made manifest in our cities, but are certainly have reverberations both statewide as well as nationally. Those particularly are, I think, grounds for which new coalitions are being formed.
Pete, yes, and stick with me on education for half a moment, if you will, because it seems like it would be inescapable to see that parents across this country, you named several states across the country just now in your response, parents across the country seem to be waking up to what not only their schools have been doing, but what the management of the unions is doing with the schools. And they seem not to get the message. You and I have talked before about probably what
I think we both consider may have been the worst thing we read all of last year, which was the head of the L.A. Teachers Union saying, A, there's no learning loss, and B, let's be thankful that our children learned other things like the words insurrection and coup. Yeah. Boy, are they tone deaf, or are they? I mean, do they not care? Maybe they don't care.
Well, again, I think it's one of those things where if you've been riding in a Cadillac for so many years with such really unchallengeable power, it becomes very difficult to see a world in which you are not in power. And I remember during the leading up to the Virginia election, when I saw pollsters releasing information about where parents of public school kids were at, I've never seen that as a broken out survey category. But when I saw that and saw that that was a group, I think at the time was 55-45 in the support of Youngkin, that to me was a real bellwether. And if we continue to see parents of public school kids as a political category, that is, in and of itself is going to be, to me, a major marker in a change of how we think about state politics.
I wanted to get your read, Pete, on, I know it's something you think and teach and talk a lot about, but I wanted to get your read, if I could, on the state of the nation and the state of this presidency. We had talked earlier about Joe Biden's approval rating coming in at about 33% favorable. And this was the same week that he gave what will probably be his most famous speech as a president, or at least it is until now, in Georgia, which I think by most claim, even I've seen liberals on TV saying this was about as divisive and maybe even the most divisive political speech they have seen from a president in, of the United States in their coverage. He's not only does he compare Republicans to Bull Connor and Jefferson Davis, he says, I've never seen a circumstance where not one single Republican has a voice that's ready to speak for justice. I mean, this effort to wipe an entire political party out of this, off the stage of responsible or respectable political dialogue is really quite something, but also maybe quite telling. Maybe they're tone deaf, or maybe they don't care either. I don't know. I don't know if their ideology has become so hardened and they've given up on the idea of uniting. I don't know if they really believe this stuff, or I don't know if they're just grasping at straws because nothing else has worked.
Yeah. It was an outrageous speech, Seth. And if it does go down as his most memorable, then it can only tarnish his broader legacy. To your point, you know, I've heard it said on one of the other Salem hosts, Hugh Hewitt show, that once you've really lost Peggy Noonan, you really run into some challenges here. In her piece, she just tears this speech apart, and in particular, your question about is this where the overall party is and do they know or they care about the impact? There's one sentence in this first paragraph where Noonan writes, it is poor political practice when you fail to guess the effects of your actions. And that very much, whether it was intentional or not, and I guess what also makes it so outrageous, and I think it's worth everybody's watching Senate Minority Leader McConnell's response, which was...
May have been the best thing he's ever done, by the way.
That may have been his best. I totally agree.
Yeah.
With that. But it, what McConnell got to was not only was in the president's speech, was he, in a Manichaean way, taking on all on the center right or on the right who have particular policy support for even maintaining the status quo in election administration. But he was also taking on many democratically run states who in many instances, including the state of New York, the Senate Majority Leader's home state, including Delaware, the president's home state, that the many of these policies that are being proposed now by the Democrats are at conflict with their own home state.
Right. Right.
And so
to put a color on that, just to fill that out, I had election expert, I'm sure you know him, Hans von Spakovsky, on the other day.
Oh, sure.
Yeah, right. Okay, and he was pointing out what Joe Biden was declaiming against in Georgia. If that's a bad thing, it's worse in Delaware and in many East Coast states. Exactly. Okay, go ahead.
That's right.
Yeah.
And again, yeah, so to look at even the Georgia reforms, I mean – They're far better than other states and far what you might call liberal than what they were 2 or 3 years ago. And somehow this is in the crosshairs of the president as saying this is Jim Crow, whatever, 2 or 3.0. I forget what version we're mm-hmm. up to now mm-hmm. in the president's vernacular. But it really was disturbing. It was disturbing to hear that kind of polarizing language coming from someone who not even a year ago in his speech, in his swearing-in ceremony, said that he was going to be a unifier.
Mm-hmm.
And
mm-hmm.
he was anything but that on the speech in Atlanta this week.
Can I underscore how important that is? It's important not just because it's showing a conflict between what he said and what he's done and what he's saying now. It's important, I think, because probably almost every independent I know that voted for Joe Biden voted for him for that reason, that unification
yep.
reason, or in their words, really the opposite point, too much division in America, and that he could
yep.
he could overcome that. So he gets into this position, and it's not as if you get there by accident. I mean, you have a mandate
yep.
struck down 6-3 that no one really ever had done before or tried before. It was unique, it was novel, and even to him, but the year before he issued it, unconstitutional. And then you end up with a 33% support by the end of this week while you're calling Republicans you're calling Republicans Bull Connor and instantiating Jim Crow 2.0. How do you crawl out of that? I mean, we have seen people at high levels of polling go south. That can happen. That can happen very quickly. It's very hard, absent some kind of force majeure that you can stand up to, by the way, requiring you to stand up to a moment, right? It's very hard to get back up, isn't it? I would think.
Well, it is, especially when you use that language.
Yeah.
You know, the American public will understand errors made in, say, that are consistent with somebody's personality, right? What they will not understand is when errors are made that are contrary to one's perceptions of that person.
Yeah, yeah.
And so in this particular sense, the people voted for President Biden to be the unifier, to be the person that made the train run on time. And here we have Afghanistan, COVID issues, and a very angry and polarizing figure. And you're right. These aren't things to apologize for. I don't know how you come back from those kinds of errors.
Peggy had in her piece a point that I think it's worth taking home with, which is, you know, her concern wasn't Joe Biden. It was the party. It is
yeah.
the party. People should remember that.
Yeah.
When we said it was the party, people said, nah, the party's still moderate. Okay, well, show yeah. me where. Pete Peterson, yeah. bless you, sir. Again, a happy new year, and we'll catch up again in a fortnight.
Sounds great, Jeff.
Enjoy. Thanks for your time and your brain.
Thanks for listening to the Town Hall Review. Our program is coming today in partnership with the Pepperdine Graduate School of Public Policy. It's America's most unique graduate leadership programs offered on Pepperdine's breathtaking campus in Malibu, California. Learn more at publicpolicy.pepperdine.edu. If you're enjoying the podcast, please tell a friend to go to Town Hall Review and sign up as well today.
3-star General Michael J. Flynn, head of the Pentagon Intelligence Agency, knew all the government's dirty secrets.
He was one of the most respected generals in the military.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to. He understood its funding.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
The explosive new documentary, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, and covers the facts behind this scandal.
Flynn told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire.
I find out the worst enemy that I'm going to face in my life is right here in America. They took my assessment and they wanted me to change it. And I was like, I'm not changing it.
They had to get rid of Flynn.
With in-depth interviews, archival footage, and never-before-seen personal records of the man behind the headlines.
I just felt like I was drowning.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.